Welcome to the Ascend Podcast. We're your hosts. I'm Chris Hopper.
And I'm Dan Harrison.
Each week we delve deep with some of the brightest and most forward-thinking out-of-the-box minds in health, consciousness, mindset, and spirituality.
This show inspires our listeners to improve their body and mind, and our intention is to fuse and unlock the conscious warrior and shift the balance in the current paradigm.
Well, the most important idea in the world, really, is that all living things are related, and that each species gets most of what it has from species that existed before it. As far as where things will evolve to, that depends entirely on what the environment favors, and it doesn't always favor very high intelligence, and it doesn't favor very high intelligence forever. I will be the first person to tell you that almost everything in the universe I don't understand.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think I understand so little, it's amazing that I can actually function in the world. But we can function on very little understanding. I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing. It's probably both. To me, a person who thinks they know a lot is an ignorant person, and a person who understands that we know very little is the kind of person you can learn something from.
Hey, what is up, everyone? In this episode of the Ascend Podcast, we're joined by Carl Safina to discuss animal consciousness. The conversation of consciousness is really a difficult conversation, and especially when it comes to animals. What level of intelligence do animals have? How much do they really feel and know their surroundings? What is the variable that we use in our mind to define that? What do we class as conscious? Are animals really thinking and feeling? What's going on inside the brains of animals? Can we know what or if they're thinking or feeling? There are a lot of weird stuff that animals and plants are doing on this planet that we don't fully understand. Is the consciousness that we know to us the only thing that's valuable? A lot of very interesting and controversial questions that we certainly wanted to have a conversation about, and we both really certainly feel to try and fully understand this crazy human experience or ride that one. We really feel we need to try and understand the things that are also on this ride with us. So anyway, this is a very interesting conversation, and a conversation that I know is very valuable in understanding animals. But before we jump with this conversation, please leave a review of the podcast, as it really helps the podcast reach more people. And please like and check out our Facebook page, is in the near future we're going to be doing some more live videos and possible podcasts as well via our Facebook page. And coming up in the future, we've got some really great ideas to keep improving the podcast for you guys, so we're really excited about them to share them with you guys. So anyway, without further ado, Carl Safina. How's it going?
Going very well.
Yeah, cool. Well, just what I want to say is welcome onto the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, definitely. We've both been looking forward to this one. And
definitely.
We've been really looking forward to have a conversation about animals and what's going on inside the minds of animals. And I think it's certainly a conversation that we don't want to shy away from in this podcast, because I think within the whole human experience, all living creatures are a part of the universe. And I really feel asking the question, what are animals really thinking and feeling? It certainly needs to be like thought about and discussed.
Yeah.
I definitely agree. And I do think it's really fascinating we actually try to put our minds into this area of what animals are really thinking. And this is a question, like Dan said, like we've been asking for a while now. And do animals have consciousness? Like, are animals conscious beings? Because this is certainly something that needs to be discussed.
Yeah, so the first thing is, what do you mean by consciousness or conscious beings? And The reason that I have to always keep asking these definition type questions, or at least give you my definition for purposes of our conversation, is that different people have different ideas of what some of these words mean. So some people think consciousness means that you're, you know, tuned into the universe in a way that comes after years of meditation or something like that. Mm-hmm. So some people think consciousness means contemplating your own death or the afterlife or those kinds of things. But I don't really think it's anything like that. I think that consciousness is the opposite of being unconscious. If you get anesthesia, it makes you unconscious, and then you regain consciousness. So what it means is that you are having experiences, you are having mental experiences, and consciousness is simply the thing that feels like something. If you feel anything, it means that you are conscious. And I think that it's very obvious and inescapable that we are conscious when we are connected to our senses, and that many other animals have exactly the same senses that we have. They have them to different extents, but you know, look around at any animal that has eyes, has ears, or you know, hearing structures in its head or along its body, and animals that have noses that use those noses obviously for smelling, they are aware of all those things. That's because their sensations are doing a job for them. They are making them aware of the world around them so they can make different decisions, go to and away from different things, and that is consciousness. Consciousness is very, very widespread.
Yeah.
It's just that, you know, different species and different people are conscious to different extents.
Yeah, I agree. There is very various different ways to expand consciousness. What I like to think of it as something I like to ask is, like, are these animals consciously aware of their own existence? Like, and are they aware of the fact in what they are? And, like, do they hold, like, any identity within themselves of who and what they are?
Well, yes. The short answer is yes. Slightly longer answer is that when we say animals, animals is everything from sponges to sperm whales. So usually we think, when we say animals in these conversations, we're thinking of things like mammals and birds. Many kinds of animals live in structured social groups where individuals matter, and individuals have different identities within the group. Many creatures who live in groups know who their friends are, who their rivals are. They know what their status is. Often they know whose baby belongs to what mother, and they function as individuals. So yes, they have an identity. And some animals have names for themselves. Wow. This has been shown with dolphins and with actually many species of parrots in the wild.
Right.
They are very, very much aware of being individuals. And a much larger array of creatures understand that they are individuals different from others or from their environment. And you can see that because they either run away, or they attack, or they eat. And when a wolf is eating the leg of a deer, it doesn't accidentally bite its own leg by mistake. It knows the difference between itself and the rest of the world around it. So yes, they are certainly conscious of their own identities in that way.
Yeah, it's amazing that. And I think it is really, it's a very interesting conversation to even just have the conversation. Do animals have consciousness? In my knowledge and the research that I've done and I've looked into, it seems to be that researchers are divided to whether even that question should be answered. And for, when I read about that, I was thinking, for me, it seems to be just ignorant, because, like, to be a human person on this planet, like, we need to step out of our human bubble, and we need to start, like, thinking differently and stop thinking we're, like, we are the center of the universe, and, like, you know what I mean?
Well, that's very threatening to many people. And the idea that the question should not be answered is not a scientific response. Yeah. I mean, science is supposed to be curious about everything and is supposed to want to know as much as possible about everything as far as the evidence leads you. And the idea that you can't ask a certain question is not a scientific idea, although there are many scientists who say those things and feel that way, but they're not being very good scientists when they do that.
Yeah, definitely. Some of the scientists I was seeing, they were saying that, and I think I had a thought about that, and I was thinking actually one of the reasons why they were saying that is because some researchers don't want to delve too far in animal consciousness, because the possibility of that, when they do start realizing that animals are conscious beings, that could also raise this other dilemma in their minds when they're actually doing the testing on the animals as well.
Yes, of course. And it makes a lot of things very inconvenient if you realize that animals, know that they are in existence and that they want to stay alive, and that there are things that give them pleasure and give them pain and anxiety. And if you insist that they don't experience anything, then you can do anything you want to them. Like, you might carve a piece of wood, not worrying about whether the piece of wood would object. And if you think that other animals have no ability to object to anything, it makes a lot of things easier. But it's simply wrong. It's just obviously wrong.
Yeah, I know. I agree, and I think it's very, this conversation though, it's happened long before the three of us were here, and even Charles Darwin himself, he was pondering the evolution of consciousness within animals, and his ideas about evolution continuing, and he's shown that he came up with a firm conclusion that if we have something like this consciously aware state, then they, meaning other animals, they have it too. So even Charles Darwin came to this conclusion that us and animals are both consciously aware of their own existence, and it's fascinating to think how much that's been played a part in the evolution of who we are and how this conversation's even started.
Well, the most important idea in the world, really, is that all living things are related, and that each species gets most of what it has from species that existed before it. And, if you just look at the incredible similarities in the nervous systems of all vertebrates, and especially all mammals, with the same kinds of hormones that make mood and motivation part of our experience, those things, and very similar brain wiring and very similar sensory organs are in many species. The idea that everything was wired up almost exactly like us and that none of it functions, and then suddenly here we are and all of it works, is ridiculous.
Yeah, the misfit, it's just like seeing a baby comes out and it's already can program a computer. Basically, it's the whole same thing, which is obviously nonsense. But something else that was fascinating, Carl, and to me, you've probably heard of this, but it's the Cambridge Declaration on Consciousness for Animals and Birds.
Yes.
Yeah, obviously the declaration, to anyone who doesn't know, it's like basically scientists from various different fields got together to understand if animals were consciously aware. And the declaration concluded that non-human animals have all these different states of consciousness. And the evidence indicated that humans are not unique in that they alone generate consciousness. Non-human animals, including all mammals and birds and many other creatures, also possess these neurological states of consciousness.
Yeah, and none of the new research that I'm aware of points to the idea that animals don't experience anything. All of the research that looks at this question seems to be coming up increasingly with the findings that they are experiencing a lot more than we have known about in the past.
Yeah, definitely. I was going to say as well, it is really interesting to think about, because we know us as human beings, we have the possibility of we have the capacity for consciousness because we think and we make decisions. And we'll have feelings and we'll have a sense of self. And obviously, each of us obviously believes that other humans have the same ability as well, which is interesting. But we don't obviously have the technology to fully go within the minds of animals around us to see what they really do feel. And I think that's interesting, because I think in the 21st century, if you do think about it, we're actually like talking about like traveling to other planets, but we still don't even understand our own consciousness. And I think we need to recognize that us as a human being, we're part of this like evolutionary progression as well as the animals. And I really think it would be very bizarre for us to think, like, and a lot of people to think, that animals do not have some form of consciousness as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we, as far as I know, we don't have the technology to know what other people are thinking. Mm-hmm. We have the technology to watch what their brain does when they are thinking. They can tell us, okay, now I'm thinking. You can see, okay, now I'm dreaming. You can watch what my brain does while I'm dreaming. You can watch what my brain does when I'm angry. But you can't feel or see what I'm thinking or feel that I'm angry through those instruments. And when we hook those instruments up to other species of mammals especially, you can see that, yes, they have exactly the same kinds of brain waves as people who are dreaming, and it looks like they're dreaming. Their eyes are moving back and forth. They're twitching. Yeah, they are dreaming. And then, you know, you watch that their brains do very similar things to what human brains do when we actually know something about what human brains are up to. All of this is extremely solid evidence that there is a lot going on in the minds, in the brains, which actually make the minds of many other kinds of animals. But on the flip side of all of that, I don't actually ever really know what somebody else is thinking. I do know that there are many people who think very differently than I do. Their sense of the world and their analysis of the world around them is extremely different from mine. It doesn't mean that they don't have a mind. It just means that their mind is different than mine.
Yeah. I think we're all very different, and that's the beauty of life, that is that we're all different, including all animals as well. And something I'd like to touch on, Carl, is still sticking on with consciousness, but like, and it's actually making me think, we're going through this evolutionary process, these animals are going to be getting more and advanced intelligence, become more aware of this world that we're living in, because humans are actually creating and destroying their worlds right as we speak right now. So it's very, very important that we start talking about these topics and how animals can actually adjust to this new life that we're actually building or creating or destroying for them. But it also makes me ask the question, Carl, do animals ask themselves questions about this reality? So will animals actually ask a question like, wow, I have to stay away from here because that's where the humans are. Should I move over here where it's going to be safer? It just makes me think, are these animals asking themselves each questions? And then how far are these questions going to evolve to?
Well, I don't know if they ask themselves these questions, but they're very good observers. They know that sometimes people are dangerous and sometimes people are not dangerous. They often will avoid places where people are dangerous and travel just a couple of miles to where people won't bother them. Inside national parks where hunting is not allowed, animals get rather tame. Outside, they're very cautious, usually. Not far at all from where I live, there are some places where it is legal to hunt deer. Deer are very hard to find in those places because they usually don't move. They only come out at night. What I've seen in some of those places, I've seen deer coming across the road from the neighborhoods where humans live, where the deer were hiding during the day near people, and going into the dangerous areas only at night when people are not allowed to hunt them. So they definitely understand the complexities of their world. And they can understand the difference between people who are dangerous and people who are not pretty often, if that's part of their world. And as far as where things will evolve to, that depends entirely on what the environment favors. And it doesn't always favor very high intelligence. And it doesn't favor very high intelligence forever.
That's very interesting.
For instance, you know, there are many things that are vastly more abundant in the world than human beings. Lots of little, you know, let's just say anchovies in the ocean. There are more of them than there are people. You could say, well, they are more successful. They don't need to be very intelligent to be successful as anchovies. So there's nothing in their evolutionary world that is pressuring them for more and more anchovy intelligence. There are a number of scientists who are looking into the future based on the trends that exist today with human beings. And, you know, some of them conclude that human intelligence will be the greatest disaster that has ever occurred on this planet, that by the time we are done with our technological intelligence, which is mostly what we have, we don't have the ability to look very far or very well in the future or to consider the consequences of what we do very well. Otherwise, we would do things a lot differently than we do. But we have this incredible technological ability, and some people who have looked at that ability say that, you know, when we're done destroying most of the forests, most of the big animals, emptying most of the oceans, and depleting most of the fresh water and polluting the air and the rivers, that human civilization will probably either destroy itself or implode upon itself in an overheated, starved out world. You know, all these things are possible. And if any of them happen, it'll be because humans were actually too intelligent for our own good and not intelligent enough for our own good. So, whether intelligence itself is really a benefit in the very long term really remains to be seen. We've only had the Industrial Revolution for a couple of hundred years. We've only had civilization for a few thousand years. What will it be like 10 or 20,000 years from now? That's not a very long time in the life of the world. But if this much has happened in the last 200 years, a lot is going to happen. And whether people will actually find the right balance or live through that is totally an open question. So how beneficial our intelligence is remains to be seen.
Yeah, definitely. I totally agree. And I was just going to say, it seemed, just to back up what you said there, it seems to me that we're living in a very interesting time where we have the technology where we have all these big, vast machines where we can actually like pull down a full Amazon rainforest. But on the other hand as well, we've also got the technology that's actually creating awareness to be to make the whole humanity aware that there's processes in place that aren't right. And I think it's just I just wanted to bring it up because I think it's a very interesting time where it's sort of like you said, it's like we need to get that balance right between them two worlds.
Yeah, exactly. I hope the day never comes where the surviving people look back on our time and cannot comprehend how destructive and stupid we were.
Yeah, definitely. I was thinking as well, like, just come to your mind there, but I was just imagining if it, like an extraterrestrial race was actually above us now and was actually watching us, what would they be actually thinking about what we're doing?
I'd like to know what they're thinking about the US presidential campaign.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
They probably are the US presidential campaign.
Yeah, that could be.
Just to jump back as well before Carl as well, because we were touching on consciousness. Something else that I find really fascinating is, and I really do think is fascinating about. So we're talking about before, we are like aware that animals do have consciousness, which we obviously us three fully believe in some form or another. Something I was thinking about to take this a bit deeper was animal collective consciousness. And like, do animals have this ability to like transcend this collective consciousness? Because what was interesting to me, I heard a podcast a while ago by you've probably heard about this, but Robert Sheldrick, where he talks about morphic resonance. Have you heard of that?
No, I've heard of him, but no, I haven't heard of that concept.
Yeah, he has a really interesting study. It was like about rats learning, and it was like a study about rats. But he was actually talking about how memories can actually pass across like both space and time from the past. And what he was actually proposing, that there's like certain self-organizing systems, like such as molecules, cells, plants, even animals, and like animals communities as well, have collective memory in which each individual draws from and can also actually contribute to, which I thought very interesting. And what I found interesting about the study as well was actually they had the rats, like it was like a maze of water, and the rats actually learned to escape from the maze. But what's interesting about is actually the older generations were learning faster and faster. But what was interesting about that study, the study stopped for a few years, and then in another part of the world, the study started up again, and the rats actually continued like to improve and improve. And that's really fascinating to me, because rather than like being this epigenetic effect, sorry, it's like that's suggesting to me what Robert Sheldrake was saying about amorphic resonance, which is really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, without reading any of that, because I have not read any of that, I have to say that I am not inclined to believe that it exists. So I just made myself a note to look into that.
Yeah, it's really interesting, just because when I read it, obviously I'm not fully clued up on it, but when I read about it, it was obviously when I read all that study, that just sprung in my mind, because I fully believe that like human beings have this collective consciousness. But when I read that as well, that was definitely proposing an argument that certain animals may even have this collective consciousness as well, just like us, which is really fascinating.
Well, what do you mean by collective consciousness in human beings? Because I don't see it. What I see is human beings that live very close to one another. Maybe we see this a little more in the U.S. because there are so many different kinds of people and so many new arrivals and so many cultures. And they seem, I mean, they can't even really get along most of the time. Or if they do get along, it's because they tolerate the differences and they have a good attitude about it. But not because, as far as I can tell, not because there's a collective consciousness that develops on its own without being taught things or without learning or experience in each individual life. So what do you mean by collective consciousness in humans?
I mean, I don't fully know if there is this like collective like human consciousness, but I certainly feel there is. I mean, just take like previous ancient civilizations, for example. We talked about this on previous podcasts, but it seems to be by them doing the things that they were doing, like building the pyramids and other things, they seem to be tapping into some like collective consciousness to spark like future generations' minds. And looking back into my journey, the pyramids certainly did something for me. Yeah, that sort of sparked my mind to like look out of the norm. But another example I can think of, just like take the internet for example. So if you would tell someone like say 30 years ago that all the world's knowledge and information was flying over our heads, they would look at us like we're stupid. But now imagine telling that like to our ancestors like 2,000, 3,000 years ago, like they would think you were absolutely crazy.
Well, don't you think that happened just because there were some records you could access because you're educated and curious, and that's why you were able to jump that gap rather than, you know, something more, I don't know, ethereal?
Yeah, maybe you're right, maybe it is, but also to my thinking as well, because it seems to me that that story as well, I've talked to that story about a few people, and they sort of have that same feeling, that same resonance in the body, and they sort of have that same feeling about that story as well. So it's quite interesting if like a lot of people are actually like thinking the same thing, maybe there is some truth in that.
Could be.
Yeah, definitely.
It is.
Sorry, I didn't interrupt. I was actually just listening in the back there, but I think he's both definitely have a very good point on both this subject. And I think what's interesting is like what I was thinking of there is the understanding of like say like you're brought into a family of hunters. So what I was thinking there was if I'm brought into a family of hunters and my grandfather was a hunter and my great grandfather was, I feel like I would already have an advantage being in the wild because I'm more programmed from my past genetics to be in that position. That's how I was presuming it as.
Yeah.
Well, depends. I guess it depends on how you look at those kinds of things.
Yeah. Something sparked in my mind again there, Carl, but I was thinking in my head there. I mean, obviously you might know a bit about this, but it was just interesting because, do you know when like birds, so you know like when birds actually lose the parents, but then the birds are actually still aware how to build nests and things like that, does that play into the collective consciousness in your mind?
Well, no. Not in my mind, anyway. I mean, I can only tell you what my impressions of the world are, and I can't tell you if my impressions are right, but
birds,
there are a lot of animals that can do a lot of very complicated things without anybody teaching them how to do it. And, you know, we usually call that instinct. And to me, the idea that you have a program in your brain that at some point executes properly, so that you build a nest and you, you know, you do all these complicated things that come instinctively that nobody taught you how to do, I think of that as instinct. I don't think of that as collective unconscious. If you want to label that as a collective unconscious, that's then that's what it is, if that's how you define collective unconscious. To me, when I hear collective unconscious, I think of thoughts going through space and somehow all the things that certain people have learned become known by other people without it being part of their genetic program to know these things. So it's more like mind reading, except it's sort of like you know, just mind transferring of thoughts and learning things that you don't get from your genes, information you don't get from your genes. That's how I think of collective unconscious. And I don't see good evidence for that myself. I think that some of these things that may seem like it are just instincts, instinctive programs that are in the genes of various species. But, you know, like I say, I mean, there could be, you know, vast gaps in what I'm aware of. I'm not arguing against it. It's just that I don't quite see it the way that I think of it.
No, I think that's actually really fascinating insight, to be honest, because I like hearing different minds on the subject. And that makes me also wonder, like, where did this program come from as well? Like, is it just like an evolutionary process, or did we actually just...
It certainly appears to be an evolutionary process. I don't know if anybody knows exactly how
that evolutionary process happens.
Exactly how different neurons are rigged up to make the program that can execute that, you know, based on certain other genes that trigger the execution of these programs. But some of this kind of stuff is known. I don't think the most complicated of it is known. But, you know, so people know that there are certain neurons in the brain, for instance, that when exposed to certain kinds of hormones produce sensations of pleasure or of fear. And they do know something about what genes control those the building of those neurons and those structures, and what genes turn on and off certain kinds of hormonal systems at different times. So some of that is known, but a lot of it is currently not known.
Yeah, I think it's beautiful though that, like you said, it's currently not known. I think we are in a beautiful time where, like, we're having conversations now, and obviously we all do have different opinions, and I think it's beautiful because we really are getting a time where we can actually, like, ask these deeper questions. And I think it really is exciting time. And I think, because something I actually thought of in my head there, so it seems to me that there's, if we look at the world now, there seems to be all these different, like, levels of communication going on around us. And it seems to me sometimes that our mind can't even comprehend it. So there seems to be, like, there's a lot going on that we don't understand. And I think we really are in a world where there's so much intelligence around us. And I think sometimes we only see certain forms of communication because we'll actually focus on it. And I really do think there's so many different forms of intelligence, energy, and communication going on between humans, insects, birds, trees, and all these different other animals as well. And I think as well, sometimes if you don't have these conversations, what we're having now, I feel like sometimes you might be actually shutting yourself off from that world.
Yes, I think that that's true. And we, you know, we've only known about the structure of DNA for less than one human lifetime.
Yeah.
in the next few centuries, if people can still be doing research and asking these questions, considering how fast we've learned what we've learned, it's mind-boggling. I will be the first person to tell you that almost everything in the universe I don't understand.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think I understand so little, it's amazing that I can actually function in the world. But we can function on very little understanding. I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing. It's probably both.
It's interesting.
It is. I think it is. We really are at an interesting time where if we do think about, like I said before, if we don't think about subjects too far, like you said before, it sort of seems when you do go down these spirals in your mind, you start figuring out, when you find out more things, you start realizing you actually don't know nothing. And you start realizing if you didn't actually go down that wormhole in your mind, you actually start thinking that if you didn't do that process, you might have just been cutting ourselves off from these other amazing possibilities in the world.
Yes, of course. You mentioned Charles Darwin. One of the things he said that I love, because he was maybe the most insightful man in history, or certainly one of the most insightful and empathetic men in history. He said, "It's always important to perceive clearly our ignorance."
Wow.
So, often we're surrounded by people who think they know a lot. And to me, a person who thinks they know a lot is an ignorant person. And a person who understands that we know very little is the kind of person you can learn something from.
Yeah. Just to bounce off that, what you said there as well, because I think it's something, a culture that ties in with animals as well, but off what a statement you said there, it seems to me the Native Americans, because the Native Americans seem to be like a civilization that was very aware of all these different avenues, and they had these open minds in all these different areas, especially when it comes to animals as well. And what I liked about the Native Americans was that when it comes to animals, they really did have this less distinction between humans and animals.
Well, almost all tribal people who lived at a simpler level of technology.
Yeah.
First of all, that was the world they were in all the time. Mm-hmm. And, their mind would be boggled going to a modern city. They wouldn't know what to do. They would die probably because they wouldn't even know where food is. Mm. As familiar as we are with our modern life, they were that familiar with the life that they had, and a lot of it had to do with animals, and the balance of power between them and other animals was much, much closer. It's only when the balance of power got way out of whack after the invention of firearms that people started to lose their respect, and at the same time most people started to have no experience or much less experience with real animals in the real world. So there are those two things going on. But it's not just Native Americans, it's many tribal people, including the Native Australians, including the San Bushmen in South Africa and Namibia, and presumably including our own ancestors, although they didn't really leave very good records about their feelings and experiences. But there were enough of these other people around who were studied by early anthropologists in the 20th century that we have a better understanding of what they were like pretty much at the end of their time.
Yeah, I was going to say as well, it seemed to me that like all these, when you said all these different tribes as well, not just the Native Americans, but they seemed like they respected animals as well, because obviously they give animals equal rights to humans. And I know obviously they hunted them as well, but there's obviously a lot of records where they actually talk about how like they have this spiritual connection, where they actually ask the animal spirit like for this sort of like a spiritual connection, like a permission from the animal.
Sure, right, yeah. Right. One thing about Native Americans in the U.S. is that some of them still retain some of those values about their respect for wild animals. And we have a raging controversy about wolves, in parts of the U.S. where there are still some wolves. There are a lot of people who are trying to let them recover, and an equal number, or maybe even slightly more, who want to kill them all again. And in one area, there are Native Americans, a Native American group that is suing to stop wolf hunting because they, you know, they don't have any problem with wolves, and they respect them a lot, and they consider them to be their brothers in a sort of spiritual sense. Mm-hmm. It's the European culture, both in Europe and I think sometimes a lot more so in the U.S., that you know, is so estranged from animals that they you know, they're frightened about everything about them. Wolves in the U.S. are extremely feared by people, and they are usually like a metaphor for viciousness and evil. But in all of the Western Hemisphere, wolves have killed two people.
Yeah.
You know, anything else that ever kills people has killed way more than two people, like automobiles or guns or, you know, the common cold or falling coconuts or lightning.
Yeah.
But people are much more afraid of wolves than they are of coconuts.
Yeah, definitely. Before as well, I just want to jump back because you were saying it before about that story about the Native Americans, like, sort of trying to sue the company because they're actually, like, obviously, they understand the animal, sort of, say, and I think it's really interesting because it seemed to me that, especially the Native Americans as well, they seem to have this, like, in all these other cultures as well, they had this interwoven spiritual connection between the human and animal, and that's what they do realize. And I know as well, a lot of, obviously, ancient cultures as well, they talked about how animal spirits as well, and they had obviously had the belief that they had this spiritual idea that the universe and all these different objects within the universe have these sort of souls and spirits as well.
Yes, right. Yeah.
I think it is. It's a really interesting conversation because I think when it comes to even creatures on this planet, and it was something I want to ask you as well. But I was wondering, do you actually think that these animals are just like us, and they maybe have a soul as well, but they maybe just like in a very different spacesuit to us?
Well, many people believe that. Mm-hmm. I don't believe humans have souls, if what you mean by soul is an eternal identity that survives after death and does not have a bodily form. I don't think we have that.
Wow.
If you look at the array of different religious views, it goes from the idea that we are in this big karmic wheel and that we as individuals with our individual identity existed in, you know, much lower life forms, mm-hmm. like insects, and then we get higher and higher and higher, and eventually we get fully enlightened, but we keep coming back to life all these times. And then in Christian religion, it's this sort of weird lopsided truncation where you don't exist and you don't have a soul until partway through your development as a fetus. At some point during that time, you are given your soul, but then that soul exists for all of eternity.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think of that, I mean, in my religious upbringing, if you think about how you did not exist at all before you were conceived and, you know, before you were partway through being formed into the infant that was you when you were born, and you didn't exist at all before that, I believe that we just don't exist at all after we die.
Whoa.
Because I don't really see any good evidence that we do, and it doesn't really make any sense to me that we do. It's possible that we do, and it's possible that my impression is wrong, but that's how I think of it. And I think that that does not mean, I think for many people, they're very frightened by that idea because it mm-hmm. means that life is meaningless and all of this is meaningless. And if we all just end, what's the point of anything? But to me, it focuses us in the reality that we actually are in, which is that we're in this life. That makes it a very, very profound, very important, incredibly mysterious and beautiful thing. I don't think it detracts from it at all. In fact, I think it makes it more beautiful. I know I've been exposed to a lot of thinking of people who think that they're going to go to heaven and live forever, so it's okay if life right now sucks.
Yeah.
And I don't think that way.
I respect that, Carl. I really understand. I quite agree that a lot of people do actually think that this idea of heaven as well is just like a way out. And like a way out of like, oh, well, I've lived a terrible life, but at least my soul can live on in heaven. But I like to think of it as well as like we are all like a form of energy, and this energy inside of us keeps on like living, or like keeps on like going into a different a different existence, I like to think, but whatever that is, I'm not too sure. I don't, and that's the beauty of life, is that we're not sure, and eventually we're all going to find out in one way or another. But
or maybe not.
Or maybe not, whatever happens.
Right.
Well, especially with technology, how we're going on, who knows what happens. Exactly right. But I think it's a fascinating viewpoint on like the life after death, and it's very interesting how we rarely talk about this on the podcast, but that the understanding of death itself is a beautiful process, because to me, like, the death of anything is just the beginning of something else, and that's what I like to think of it as. I don't know, you might seem different, Carl, but that's the beauty of life, is that we're all different.
Well, you know, I guess I see it happening at a different level when our, you know, when our bodies fall apart. I think we can all agree that our bodies fall apart after we die. And when our bodies fall apart, all of these molecules that incredibly made us who we were, made us feel how we felt, made us remember what we remembered, they all are totally dismantled, and then it starts the entire life process all over again. And you know, even that we have found a way to seal ourselves off of, which I think is probably the most unbeautiful thing about our thoughts of life and death, is that we now have these caskets that try to prevent us from being part of this eternal cycle, even our body from being part of this eternal cycle. But to me, there's incredible beauty and great metaphysical mystery in the idea that, you know, first there's grass, and then there is an animal that eats the grass that wants to run away from the wolf that eats the animal that becomes the wolf, that wants to eat more of those animals, and eventually the wolf itself dies and becomes grass again.
Yeah, the circle of life, really, isn't it?
Yes, entirely.
I was going to say as well before, just want to touch on a point as well, because Chris brought it up before, actually, but when he touched on with you before, and he was talking about the evolution in animals, because I want to jump back to this later on, but he was talking about how... what sprung to my mind anyway, that it's, cause it seems to me that we're in like this state of evolution. So it seems to me that obviously animals are also, us as humans are also evolving, but also animals are evolving as well. So I think that's an interesting sort of spin as well, to actually think how animals are going to actually evolve along this process, to go a bit deeper as well. Especially with, as well, if you think about, especially with how our technology is advancing in, with our communication with people and things like that, and the way that we are creating environments for animals as well, it makes us question like how are animals going to evolve with alongside humans.
Well, I hope they do evolve alongside humans, because there are a lot of animals whose evolution is in total turmoil and chaos right now, and there are a lot of other animals that whose lineage is ended. They are going extinct, or they are recently extinct. And the important thing to understand about evolution is that there is not a directionality to evolution that makes the logical endpoint an improvement on the current situation. There was obviously a point in human evolution where being more and more clever with technology and more cooperative with people in your group was extremely important for survival, and became more and more part of what it was to be this species that we are. Mm. But many of those evolutionary pressures are completely relaxed and working in the opposite direction. Almost none of us invent or make anything. An Eskimo who had some sort of catastrophe happen to them would know how to make all the tools he used. We don't know how to make most of anything that we use. We rely on other people giving us things that we can just buy. We don't know where our food comes from, even. We sometimes, and there are many people who do much better cheating and taking advantage of other individuals than cooperating with them for the greater good, because the greater is undefined now. We live in gigantic anonymous crowds, not small tribal groups where everyone knew each other and everyone depended on everybody. So those pressures that made us the species that we like to think we are largely working now in the exact opposite direction. Yeah. It's easy to imagine that 100,000 years from now, people will mostly be a lot less intelligent and much more dangerous.
Yeah. I think that's very interesting, Carl. It's like the process of devolving, really. Like, we're going to get to a state of like a being where we intelligent so far in intellectually intelligent, but then we're going to jeopardize it somehow. Maybe even we already are jeopardizing it by staying too much on our screens or trying to get too much information at once. We're actually jeopardizing our evolutionary process to the point where we're actually devolving, and that's something I've been contemplating.
Well, I think that that's a risk, and I think that that's a possibility.
I think it is a scary possibility, Carl, because I think a lot of people don't really understand the impact of what everything's happening onto their body right now. I mean, like, especially with the food industry, it's becoming, with the amount of chemicals that's actually going into these animals and that we're consuming, these are going to have a long-term effect on our children and our grandchildren. And the evolution of them, that stage is just going to constantly change. And so we're either going to get to a state where these medicines that we're consuming are either not going to affect us, or we're just going to actually get physically weaker. So we're actually going to be in a state of devolving. And it's a very interesting topic of conversation. But if you look at it, other animals outside of being consumed from human consumption, these animals are actually becoming more evolved because they're actually using everything what they've already been taught, whereas we're not. This is all new to us. Mm-hmm. Whereas animals are actually still evolving in their own sense. They're still getting used to like hunting in the wild, whereas we can't do that no more. That's all gone. And this is where we're in the interesting part in time now, where anything can happen. And this is what we really need to understand is, is animal intelligence going to be up there or even surpass human intelligence?
Well, anybody who thinks they know the answer to that question is wrong, because who knows?
Yeah.
My main concern is that we simply understand that we are here with a lot of other creatures who want to be here, and their claim to existence is equal to ours. They are of this earth every bit as much as humans are of this earth. They actually hurt the world a lot less than we do.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's, in that sense, they may have a stronger moral claim to existence. And unless we understand who we're here with, we won't be here with them for very much longer.
I was actually thinking this in my mind the other day. I was walking along the road and I was actually thinking, if would it be just best, it sounds horrible saying this, but it's just being real with myself and my thought, but I was actually thinking if it would just be best if like us as humans just like disappear off this planet and just let animals be animals, because it seems to me, and sometimes in a way, that animals seem to be this ultimate peaceful soul.
Well, if they could vote on that, we would be voted off the island.
Yeah, we would.
Yeah. Because we're the ones who make trouble for everything else.
Yeah, definitely. I was going to say as well, Carl, before as well, because Chris touched on a point that sparked in my mind when he was talking about the evolutionary process of animals, and he was talking about how all these chemicals are getting put in vegetables, and chemicals getting put in also in animals as well. I was actually thinking maybe in the future we could get to a point in time where, like, plants actually become consciously aware and animals actually become consciously aware of the fact that they are getting chemicals put inside of them, then they could actually spark an evolutionary mechanism within their body that could actually cause illness on us.
Well, I wish I could write fiction, because that's a really good plot for a movie.
I think I have a point, because plants do have a self-defense mechanism as well.
Yeah,
though.
That's what I was thinking.
So plants would actually evolve to just try and protect themselves from humanity, really, just like all the other animals.
Yeah,
would.
And I was actually thinking, if they actually see the threat, if animals, especially animals and plants as well, see the threat in humans, what we're doing to them, that actually could just spark this evolutionary mechanism inside them to, like, sort of kill off all the humans.
Well, you know that, in a sense, bacteria are doing exactly that.
Yeah.
They are becoming immune to antibiotics, and they are killing a lot of people. So, in a way, exactly what you said is happening.
Yeah.
Well,
I think something else just sparked in my mind there as well, which is another side of this conversation. Sort of contradicts what I've just said in my mind there as well. But I was something that sparked in my mind. I was thinking as well, because we're living in a world now where we have domesticated all these animals as well, and a lot of these animals actually rely on us to survive. So if they did actually wipe us out, maybe they would die as well, because a lot of animals are actually relying on us to survive. The way it's set up now.
Yeah, that's true. The domesticated animals would have a very difficult time.
Yeah.
Not that many domesticated species, though. There are only... if you think about the species we use for food, mm-hmm. there are thousands and thousands of varieties. But as far as species, there's basically chickens, turkeys, geese, only one species of goose of all the many species of geese that live in the world. Only one has been domesticated. There's cows, pigs, sheep, goats. Only one species of each of those has been domesticated. And what else? I mean, a very small handful of other things at a very relatively insignificant level. There are some domesticated quail and other things like that. But basically, there's only about, 6 or 8 birds and mammals that make up probably 98% of all human food from domesticated animals. Those would do badly, and there are gigantic numbers of them. But everything else, all the wild animals would, all the wild plants, and all the wild systems would suddenly be relieved of a tremendous amount of various kinds of pressures that we inflict.
Yeah,
I think that's a really good point and a good way of looking at it, really. And Carl, one final question, and it's something that I would love to hear your answer to. If you could create an ideal utopia for animals and humans to coexist together, what would that world look like?
Well, people would emphasize all the good things that we know about people. And there would not be people who are emphasizing all these terrible impulses. We would be caring and cooperative. We would have empathy. We would use medicine and modern health technology to both be well and to control our own reproduction so that we have stable populations. And we would leave a lot of room for all of the other millions of animals on the planet in large areas that are intact and beautiful and healthy. Mm. And that would be my vision. I don't think it's really very complicated.
Yeah, it's a beautiful vision. It's like to see that vision in our minds as well. And thank you for giving us that vision.
Yeah, thank you so much, and thank you so much. We'll wrap this up now, but thank you so much for your time again, Carl. It's honestly, it's been an absolutely fantastic podcast. Thank you so much.
I'm glad you think so. I had a lot of fun, and it was great talking to you.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you, Carl. Thanks so much for listening to the podcast, guys. A very interesting conversation, and please check out Carl Safina on Facebook and his Twitter, and check out his book called Beyond Words, and also the show notes are over at our website, ascendbodymind.com. And next week on the podcast, we also have a very special guest, which was also recorded on the 70th anniversary of the late, great Terence McKenna. And we have the honour to talk with his brother, Dennis McKenna, which, by the way, is an absolute great one. So anyway, we'll catch you next week. Peace.